So this is a talk on role-playing on TechML. It's going to focus... it's actually not a talk about role-playing per se, because I assume the people who are here already understand what that is, and it's not... That part of it isn't functionally different on TechML. I want to talk about the unique challenges and the unique rewards that TechML offers as a role-playing setting. Is there anybody in the room that doesn't already know about the TechML setting? You know, the background and who came up with it and the basic, like, history of the world and stuff? Because I can skip all of that. Okay, nobody doesn't know that. TechML, through the game Empire of the Petal Throne, TechML was the first role-playing game setting that was ever published. And it has gotten a reputation over the years of being weird and alien and hard for people to get into, and that's one of the main things that I want to address today. But on the other hand, the original game was very closely based on original Dungeons & Dragons, and did not have a lot of the material in it which later came out, background material, source material for the world, stuff about the culture and so forth, was absent from the original game. What you got was a role-playing game where there's empires in competition with each other. It's pre-gunpowder warfare. There's sorcery, there's temples, there's underground chambers with monsters and ancient treasures and dangerous wildernesses, and everything you need for a traditional D&D style, you know, monster of the moment, dungeon crawl, wilderness crawl type of game. But the one big difference was that it wasn't European. D&D, you know, the more or less unstated assumption was you're somewhere in Europe and in the Middle Ages, except it's a fantasy Middle Ages, and it's like those cultures, but with magic and monsters. Well, TechML isn't that, and so it has its own words for things, because these are not... we can't just go into a dictionary of French and have French cities with French names and English cities with English names. Everything has its own name in TechML because it has its own language. It's not part of an existing historical tradition. So the first hurdle that people run into when they try to roleplay on TechML are the names. How do you pronounce these crazy, crazy names? And I've got the language books that have come out, which if I felt like taking a college course in a language, I would read them a lot more carefully and maybe try to do that. I can't do that. I'm a gamer. I have other demands on my time to pay my bills, and then I want to sit around a gaming table and have fun and not worry too much about this language stuff. But on the other hand, you don't want to get it terribly wrong. So over the years, I've come up with what I think is a helpful piece of advice that will get you 80 or 90% of the way toward correct pronunciation without too much effort, okay? One thing you have to understand about the Tsolyani language, that's the language of the main empire where the players begin in most TechML campaigns, is that their vowels always sound the same. It's not like English where two vowels together can give you a different sound, or having it in a different place in the word gives you a different sound. Their A always has the same sound, E always sounds the same, every single one of their vowels is the same. And it's this. A-E-I-O-U in Tsolyani is pronounced A-A-E-O-U. With me now. A-A-E-O-U. You can kind of feel it in your mouth that the A starts way in the back. A-E-O-U. By the time you're at OO, your lips are out and you're You know, the sound is moving forward with each sound. It's an easy way to help you remember the structure of it. And what I did literally is I would be driving around and seeing street signs, like a stop sign. No, that's a stop sign because, oh, I pronounce the vowels in Sulianni for practice. And you do that for a little while, and it'll become second nature. And that, and most of the difficulty in pronouncing Sulianni, I think, is in the vowels and not so much in the consonants. They do have some weird consonant things going on, you know, no doubt. But you're going to raise a lot fewer eyebrows if everybody's on the same page with the vowels. So once you've jumped that hurdle, you've got this great non-European fantasy role-playing game where you can go out and kill monsters and take their stuff just like in D&D. So what the hell was the point of going to the extra effort of learning how to pronounce the words? You can already do that in D&D, right? What's great about the Tekamel setting, and really this is true of any fantasy role-playing game setting, but I think Tekamel, I don't think anybody can argue that there is another published setting for a fantasy role-playing game that is as wide and deep and elaborate as Tekamel, right? And that has as much to offer in this regard. It gives your adventures a context. In, like, if you're playing Dungeons and Dragons, you meet it typically. You meet in a tavern, you hear a rumor, oh, there's a dungeon outside of town, and you tromp over there and you bash open the door and you go in and you kill monsters and you take their stuff, right? And you go, yay, I went up an experience level. But the question is hanging there, where did that dungeon come from? Why are those monsters in there? Who owns that plot of land that the thing is on? Don't they care about the fact that we just went rooting around in their storm cellar? These questions are not addressed if you don't have some kind of context in which all this is happening. And the Tekamel setting provides that. It will tell you where these monsters came from. Maybe not each specific one, but like, you ever wonder, why are there basilisks in D&D? Are they a natural creature? I guess in the later games they kind of started saying that, right? But in early D&D, it's like, it's a thing, right? It looks like that, it has these powers. We don't know, it might have been made by a wizard, it might be a naturally occurring creature, it might be something from another plane, we just don't know. In Tekamel, you know. And we know if certain kinds of creatures are servitors for different gods or demons. We know if they are constructs of the ancients that are like, you know, security robots guarding ancient treasures. All of that stuff is covered. And there's further questions like, really? You just met in a bar and before that you had no existence? You don't have a family? You don't belong to any organizations? You don't have any allegiances with anyone? You're just this, you're a murder hobo, as often stated, right? I mean, yeah, you're a guy who goes around and kills things, takes their stuff, gets rich and powerful. Well, in Tekamel, all of that is provided. You get a place in society. You have a family. And you are committed to a particular religious cult, and you're a citizen of a particular empire, and that all matters as far as the story surrounding why are you going out to that place and killing those monsters and taking their stuff. Who wanted you to do that? Who said that was okay? Who are you pissing off by doing that? Who do you work for that benefits from you doing that? This is all what you get when you bring all of the context of the Tekamel setting on board. This leads to further interesting things like in Sulianu, just as a point of detail, legally everything belongs to the Emperor. So if you find the cool magic sword, that's not your magic sword, that's the Emperor's magic sword, but hopefully he is okay with you using it and holding it for him and using it, you know, in his for his greater glory. But that's a whole other kind of adventure you can have, is hiding the treasures that you found from the omnipotent Azure Legion, which is the Emperor's secret police, so that they don't come and take the choicest items away from you. Now, to know all of this stuff means you have to go out and seek out the source material for Tecmel, of which tons has been printed. I mean, a whole foot and a half wide section of my gaming shelves is taken up just with fanzines and the two volume Mictlanyal books that are about the religion, and Deeds of the Everglorious, which is this awesome little book about the history of the Imperial Legions, which you'd think would be dry, boring history stuff, but is actually one of the coolest references I've ever seen. You look up a legion that's stationed in a particular city, you will find out all kinds of cool stuff about that city and why it's neat to be an adventurer there. A lot of these things have gone out of print over the years. Professor Barker spent a few years in ill health, and he has passed away, but before he went, he organized a bunch of people from who were his longtime players into the Tecmel Foundation, who are now up in Minneapolis with the contents of Professor Barker's basement and garage, and they're cataloging all this Tecmel material that he generated since the 50s. There are rumors of more novels. I'll get to the novels in a minute. So not only is there a potential for more material to come out, but they are taking on the responsibility of getting the previously published stuff out there again. And so the material is available. Anyway, my point is that you can, on the one hand, run a dumb little dungeon crawl campaign where it's just about what underworld place are we going in today, Bob, to kill monsters and take their stuff. It will transform with the context of the world of Tecmel. That can transform into a saga about conflicts between political forces, exploration of the questions behind ancient legends, problems with conflicting allegiances that your players may have, tests of honor on the part of the player characters, and the fates of nations can hang on your dungeon adventures as long as they're taking place in the context of this world. That's what you get out of it. Because the player characters in Tecmel are not murder hobos. They are citizens of the Empire. They are members of a clan. They are part of a temple, and they have friends, not just the other player characters, but other people that they know and have dealings with. But this takes you to the second hurdle with Tecmel, and that is all these details about the world and the culture and the religions and all this stuff. There is no way around it. If the Game Master wants to tap into all this material, they're going to have to do some reading. And this is another place where some people get daunted by the setting. Because, you know, they scratch the surface, they see how much more stuff there is, and they go, how can I ever be expected to understand all of this stuff and get it all right? Particularly since as much material as there is, it's still not absolute. I mean, Professor Barker did not write down the names of every single person living in every single clan house in every single city in the Empire. And even if he had, you just go next door to Mu'ugalavia, the next empire over, and then there'll be other people whose names you don't know yet. You're going to have to make stuff up. In spite of the fact that there's all this source material. So a lot of people look at that and they're just daunted. I mean, can I even run a campaign if I'm running the risk constantly of violating some piece of the culture that I just wasn't aware of that because I hadn't read that bit yet? For example, that Solyani don't use chairs. If this was Tsulyanu, we wouldn't be sitting on chairs, we'd be sitting on mats on the floor. And since I'm the important person you're all listening to, my stack of mats would be, and pillows would be higher, because I am a more important person. That's a thing in this culture, right? If you don't know that, and you run a couple of sessions, and yes, your characters go into a town, and they're invited to sit down in the chairs in the office of the clan master, and you had that scene, right? And then next week, you read something that explains the pillows and mats thing to you. You go, oh, crap, I've ruined my Tekemel. Okay. You haven't ruined your Tekemel. Because, first of all, people run historical RPGs about periods in history on which we have at least this much information, and on which those GMs are equally ignorant about most details, and they generally don't care, right? If you're running a medieval fantasy game, you're probably not everyone, some people take this a lot more seriously, right? But most GMs probably don't care if they're getting the relationship between the peasants and the local lord exactly right. You know, you kind of have a sense of what the Middle Ages was like because you've seen like Camelot movies and movies about Robin Hood and stuff like that. These pop culture versions of the Middle Ages. That's what we're really doing, most of us, if we're honest, when we run traditional medieval fantasy stuff. So the question then is there a pop culture reference for Tekemel? And the answer is yes. It's the stuff Professor Barker was enjoying back in the 30s, 40s, 50s when he was formulating the idea for Tekemel. When you see things like the planet Mongo from Flash Gordon, there are huge echoes of Tekemel in that. Like any one of those goofy scenes from the old serials where out come the dancing girls and there's a boom, 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 and they're doing that and there's a huge throne room with crazy architecture and stuff and the Emperor Ming sitting on his throne and stuff. And his Ming's awesome power and how everybody's terrified of him and how he's got a right-hand man who's always the guy that's fighting Flash Gordon. I mean, you can lift a lot of that feeling and call it Tekemel, as much as you can lift stuff from Robin Hood or Camelot and call it the Middle Ages. It's really no more off the mark. Other things, Sinbad, Arabian Nights, those movies, particularly the Hollywood versions from those time periods, that's the kind of stuff that Barker was tapping into. Another great example is the whole planetary adventure subgenre of science fiction, like, for example, John Carter of Mars, the Edgar Rice Burroughs stuff. There are, by the way, huge echoes between Barsoom from Burroughs' Mars books and Tekemel. We got Burroughs had a planet of red-skinned people. Tekemel is a planet of red-skinned people. Burroughs had a planet that used to be high-tech, but has fallen down, and now technology is sort of this underpinning on which they have a more savage, barbaric, throwback culture. That's what Tekemel is. It's not exactly the same, of course, right? Doesn't have the same races, doesn't have the same balance between ancient technology and its rarity, but clearly that another thing, six-legged animals, big thing on Tekemel, big thing in John Carter of Mars. So, if you just look at those kinds of things and say that's what my Tekemel is going to feel like, you're not going to be too far off the mark. It's not going to give you the real Tekemel, of course, but neither do you get the real Middle Ages from those pop culture medieval things. But what it will do is give you this scaffolding of just a sense of what stuff should feel like, that then as you go through the source material and you learn details, you can start hanging it on that scaffolding and constructing, transforming your understanding of Tekemel to something more accurate over time. And also, I reference the pillows and mats thing specifically in Vaithorm as an example, and chairs, right? there's all kinds of excuses you can use for how come there were chairs in that place when there shouldn't have been, right? You can say weird local custom. Barker does that himself all the time and is totally okay with it. You can say, a more extreme example is, it's a world that is permeated by these wandering nexus points. So, like, you round a corner in some dungeon corridor and go through a shimmering portal and you're in a parallel dimension without much warning. Barker used to do this to his players all the time, to just suddenly lift them out of the thing that they were doing that he got bored of and take them to some completely other place, right? You can say, well, that, you know what, that day you stepped through a portal into an almost Tekamel where they had chairs, and now you're back in the real one where everybody's sitting on pillows properly like they should. It's not that important. You shouldn't get all nervous about breaking things, because you can fix it so easily. So, where should a new Tekamel GM or player begin with going through the source material? My recommendation is the novels. Now, there's an awesome book called the Tekamel Source Book. It was one of the volumes from Swords and Glory, which was Barker's second Tekamel game. Only two volumes of which ever actually got published. It's an encyclopedic reference of all kinds of stuff about the world. Don't read that first. What you need as a GM is you need to know how stuff should feel. You don't need to know all the fiddly little details, because, again, you're just going to agonize over whether you're getting everything right. When you read the novels, you find out what the tone of an average Solyani's daily life should be like, and mostly they're hugely reassuring that it's not all that alien. It's just not. You read these things, and it's very clear that Barker was not inspired by, like, I've read a translation of The Adventures of the Monkey King from, he's a character in Hindu and Chinese mythology, but I've read a translation of this, and it's very weird. I mean, their literary structure is different, and attitudes of the characters in there are very strange and alien and stuff. The Tekamel novels are nothing like that, okay? They're like guys that have a thing to do, and, you know, they have their swords and their spells and their items, and they go off and they address these problems. It's just not alien. The other problem with the more instructional in sources, like the Tekamel source book, is that you read this stuff and, you know, Barker will say, that Solyani, their bathing habits are that in the back of the clan house, there's a place where the slaves come and they pour water on you, right? And that's how you get clean. And so you can be left with the impression that that is some kind of absolute rule, that all Solyani do like that all the time, which is like saying all Americans drive at precisely the speed limit all the time, okay? That Solyani are people, right? Anything, when a tradition, a standard way of doing things is awkward and gets in the way, if they can get away with it, they won't. They're like, they're folks. So you really get that sense from reading the novels. You know, they may pause for a second and say, I really shouldn't be hobnobbing with this guy of lower social status than me, but, you know, the need of the situation dictates that we're going to have to put up with it. It's like that. Which brings us to, just to go over some of the cool things that you'll find when you explore the source material, there's all these awesome alien races in the game. There's no elves, dwarves, and hobbits on Tekamel because there were no elves, dwarves, and hobbits in space. That's where our descendants in the future meet these alien races and ally with them and conquer Tekamel and colonize it, and that's the creatures that you can play if you're a non-human NPC on Tekamel. And the source material gives you all kinds of really fascinating stuff about their lifestyles and their attitudes about things and their dietary habits and all this kind of cool stuff. Other exciting things from the source material are the arenas in every city. They have arena combat. It's similar to what you might have come to expect from learning about ancient Rome, but not exactly. The theology of the different religions is fascinating, and you know, Barker will take things like, you know, the question of, are the gods really gods, or are they just really powerful interdimensional entities? Which is a natural question that Soleani would ask, because they can, like, dimension hop, and they run into demons and stuff, right? Who are clearly not quite gods. Maybe the gods are just more powerful things. That's actually a thing in the theology of the world, and I've run game sessions where my players have fallen to bickering over points of theology about the different gods that they follow. And it's great stuff. You'll find out about the undying wizards who occupy the college at the end of time, from which they protect the timeline of the universe and are trying to make sure that things come out a certain way. You'll find out about the demons and their different planes, and how the demons are allied with one god or another, and that's a whole other, like, political thing that's going on, is control of different planes nearby Tecumel. And you'll find out about the pariah gods, who are, they are beings as powerful as the other gods, but with no interest in the ultimate needs of humans at all. What they are after is the complete cessation of all existence. And yet they will pick individuals and, like, gift them things and give them power and help them out and stuff, to use those people on the plane of Tecumel to further their ends. All of this stuff, fascinating, awesome material for building a campaign that goes way beyond going out and killing some monsters and taking their stuff, even if you start that way. But this brings us to the third hurdle. I've gone through my material way too fast, so I hope we're going to have a lot of discussions at the end of this. This brings us to the third hurdle that you're going to discover when you start reading the source material, and that is adult content. That Soleani do not have modern-day Western moral standards. They have their own, and so they're quite comfortable with some things that make many of us squirm. Like, nudity is just a completely common, normal, everyday thing. It's a hot planet, so they mostly go around wearing next to nothing. By the way, another link to the John Carter of Mars stuff. You didn't see it in the movie, but in the books, the Martians are more or less nude. When they don't have to be, unless they don't have to be, polygamy. They got families with multiple wives and multiple husbands in the case of women who declare their Aradani status, which is just a thing female citizen is allowed to do, to say, I'm going to not take the normal place of a woman in society and operate the clan house and cook the meals and manage the slaves and do all that kind of stuff. I am going to be like a man and have business interests or join a legion and do all that kind of stuff, right? And once a woman has declared herself Aradani, she can have multiple husbands. And some of those husbands may have other wives, and so you get whole elaborate flowcharts of extended families. Slavery itself is a thing on Tecumel. These are not modern-day people. And, you know, there was slavery in the Middle Ages. It's just generally glossed over in most tabletop RPGs, right? For completely understandable reasons. It's a thing on Tecumel. And more, human sacrifice. Some of the gods of that the Soleani worship are quite happy to accept living human beings as sacrifices. This is all very, very creepy, and it can be hard to get a grasp of how you would handle that in the game without grossing everybody out, without just being outright offensive. The way I try to handle it, first of all, I start by trying to see it from the Tsolyani perspective. The Tsolyani not only believe in an afterlife, there's magic spells that will summon up the spirits of your departed ancestors, who will tell you all about their journey through the sea of time to the paradises of Teretane, and how awesome that is. So they know that their soul is going to go on. Absolutely for sure. It's not a question of faith. They just know it. And the rules on where you wind up, where your soul winds up in the afterlife, those depend on their concept of what they call right action. It's not so much external moral standards that everybody is supposed to adhere to. For the Tsolyani, if you are a priest of Vimukhla, the fire god of war, and the fire god of war demands that your captives be sacrificed to him for his greater glory, you do that, and that is right and proper for you. It would be wrong of you to try to subvert that process, because that is your place in society, and that's how they see it. Likewise, if you're a priestess of Avante, the nature goddess, you would never in a million years burn somebody alive as a sacrifice to Avante. She's not into that. And if you were that priestess and you saw the priest sacrificing his captives to the flame, you can have all the normal expected human reactions to how horrible that is. But what you would not do in the context of Tsolyani society is deny that that guy doing the sacrifice is dishonorable, because he is doing what he's supposed to do. It's much more like Japanese Bushido culture, where, we have the greatest respect for one another and our honor. And now it is, unfortunately, we must fight to the death because we are on opposite sides. It's like that. There's unfortunate fallout of this understanding that you're supposed to be a good, proper person. You are supposed to fit your place in society as best you can. If that place is you're a slave, that's what you're told you're supposed to do. Slaves are told they're supposed to be good slaves in order to get their reward in the afterlife. And likewise, human sacrifices. If you're a warrior of Karakhan, the stability side god of war, who's all about military discipline and honor and bravery and stuff like that, you go marching bravely into the flames singing your death song. That's what you do. That is the right way for you to go. That is the honorable end for you. So we look at this stuff and go, no, that's just not right, because we know that this is a ripoff. Those people are being, you know, murdered and killed and abused. The Tsolyani don't know that, and worse, they have reasons to think they're right. So that's one angle to look at it. Another way to look at it is as an opportunity to explore what is really bad about those things. My wife recently ran a session of her Baythorn campaign where my companions and I are down in an underworld, and we find a Nexus portal, and we are afraid of going in there, so we decide to use the slaves, right? Because they're carrying our stuff, and we'd rather risk one of them. So we tie a rope on, it goes through, and the rope comes back, and the slave doesn't. And so, we'll do another one. And we had suddenly a little slave rebellion on our hands. And the way she played it, the things the slave said to us made us feel bad about the way we were abusing them, and forced us as Tsolyani, within the context of our culture, I mean, nothing had changed. All the understanding of morality and all that stuff was still in place, but it was like, gee, boss, really? I mean, think of all the things I've done for you, and, you know, you're gonna, I wanna continue in this life before I go on to my reward. It was a emotionally charged sequence, and at the end of it, rather than executing my slave for disobeying me, I cuffed him once across the cheek and said, all right, you've made your point. We will not sacrifice you. It's still Tekumel, but it made us confront the issue, at least within that context. The other thing you can do is you can say, heck with it. All that stuff, keep that at arm's length. We're not going to have human sacrifices occurring in my campaign because it's going to creep up my players. We're not going to do slavery. We're not going to do this. It's maybe going on around there somewhere, but it's just not going to be part of the campaign. That's perfectly fine. Barker was always adamant that once you are playing in your version of Tekumel, you're free to handle things however it suits you best. Okay. Yeah, it's a very uncomfortable part of the talk. So, to sum it up, in my opinion, Tekumel is by far the most richly fascinating and detailed fantasy role-playing game setting ever devised. It was able to be that because Professor Barker was working on this thing for the novels that he intended to write for decades before there even was a Dungeons & Dragons. And that's why it was able to appear as a game less than a year after the publication of original D&D. And five of those novels did eventually come out. It's got an undeserved reputation as being too strange, but it really takes very little effort to start down the road of understanding it and to get yourself into a frame of mind where you can run the things that are in that culture instead of ours and instead of, you know, the Middle Ages. And it takes very little work after that to dig a little deeper and add more detail and transform your campaign from a starting point that's not too much different from D&D into a saga with these powerful themes, powerful characters, major historical events going on, and your players having a place in all of that. I think it's worth the effort. Questions?
Novels in order?
Ah, good question. I don't have that list in front of me, but it's if you go to tekumel.com, they will have that list. I know the first two are Man of Gold and Flame Song, and those were the ones published through like a traditional paperback publishing company. The remaining three were published by a small outfit that pretty much came into existence just to get the rest of Barker's books published. And they can be really hard to find. But again, the Tekumel Foundation is getting all this stuff back in print. Man of Gold is available again. There's a print-on-demand version and a ebook version. The novels are cool because I don't know if you've read the Song of Ice and Fire series at all, George R.R. Martin.
Yes.
That's now the TV series. He does a cool thing in there where every chapter is named for the character from whose perspective it's written. In Barker's books, it's kind of the same thing, except each book is from the perspective of different characters, and they start not knowing each other. Harson, in the first book, is this young priest of Thumis, the god of wisdom, he was a foundling raised by the Pechoy insect people in the forest, and so he kind of has some of their cultural attitudes and can communicate with them a little bit in their language. He gets embroiled in mighty issues that affect the fate of the empire. And then the second novel, you're with Trinesh, who is a captain, I believe, in a legion devoted to Vimukhla, the fire god. But he is no fanatic. He's constantly at odds with the priest attached to his unit, who's like, oh, great, they captured some guys, time to sacrifice them. And Trinacia's going, first of all, these ones over here helped us out. Plus, we have some questioning to do first, right? That was very eye-opening about how, again, just because the source material will talk about different traditions in Soliani society does not mean everybody is fanatically devoted to them all the time. And they go on an adventure way out to the east that has to do, ultimately turns out having to do with undermining a plot by evil forces to cause the downthrow of Soliano. And the later, in the third novel, those characters from those books are together on a mission for the Empire with another guy, Koruka, who is my favorite character in all of Barker's novels. Koruka is a priest of Xarul. He's called the Doomed Prince of the Blue Room because he's a god who got really powerful by accumulating secret personal knowledge and threatened to defeat all the other gods. So all the other gods, Stability and Change, banded together in this war to capture him, and they imprisoned him in the Blue Room, from which he is still able to exert as much power as any of the other individual gods. So he's the god of secrets and deceit and trickery and that kind of thing, right? Knowledge for personal gain. And Koruka is just not very good at it. So he's delightful. He's like trying to adhere to his temple's principles, but you know, getting attracted to was the one lady or another in his group, despite his you know understanding that no, that could really be bad for me, in keeping my secrets to myself. He's great. And as the series goes on, it brings the characters together who have been in their own books, and that's a really cool part of it. There are rumors of possibly one or more additional novels in some state of not complete yet in Barker's files, which might see the light of day sometime, because he didn't really get to the end of the cycle. It's clear there's something else going on that the characters are going at. And I don't want to say too much about what happens later, but the books would be giving them all away. I will say the first two books I enjoyed a lot. They received the benefit of professional editing from the publishers of those books. The later books, when I read them, I had a hard time getting through them. When my wife and I drive around, well, I drive and she reads, and she's been reading the third novel aloud, works a lot better aloud than it did when I was reading it, which was interesting. I didn't realize that until we were going through it, but it flows much, much better, so maybe I'd recommend that for people reading the later books. So that's a long-winded answer to your question about
Thank
books.
You.
What else you guys have questions about?
Are you working on something new? Or are you still progressing?
Yeah. The next big thing that Unigames is going to do... Professor Barker, years ago, released a product called the Northwest Frontier Gazetteer and Map Set. The original Empire of the Petal Throne came with these big vinyl maps. I had them with me last time. Two big, full-color vinyl maps of the five empires. And each of those hexagons was 133 kilometers or something. It's a huge distance. And so not really well suited to day-to-day role-playing game adventuring, because it would take you days to get out of one of those hexes. Well, then the Northwest Frontier Gazetteer and Map Set took a small portion of the empire and blew it up in much larger scale. So each of those big hexes is now 11 small hexes across, which is more like 9 kilometers, and that you can use in a tabletop RPG game a lot more easily. Plus, it's got all this detail in there, right? It shows the locations of where there's ruins and where here's a place that there's ancient legends about, and here's little all the little villages and the hills and the streams and all this stuff that would be very useful to have in an ongoing campaign. So, the first thing we asked from the Takuma Foundation after we signed the agreement for the role-playing game is, may we develop another part of the Empire to that level of detail? And because we want to come out with a continuing series of adventures for Baythorn, we need them to happen somewhere, because context, right? Takuma is all about that. It's a lot harder to take an adventure from Takamel and rip it out of the place it was supposed to happen and stick it somewhere else, because it ties into the history and the local politics and stuff too much. So we wanted a region. So in the north, kind of in the northwest of the Empire, but well within the borders, there's this place called the Kurt Hills, which is a forested hilly region with a local people who are kind of indigenous woodland folk who live up there, and that's at the center of the region we're going to do, and then also all the plains around it with several cities, and we're going to come out with a Kickstarter to fund the creation of this whole thing. Part of it is like the lower. The southwest corner of it already is in the Baythorn rulebook, but we're going to build out from that, and that's the next big thing for Baythorn. I have another adventure that was actually promised from the original Kickstarter, which isn't done yet, and that's happening too. Part of the reason it's slow is because it's an adventure that I had written for a different part of the Empire. I have to refigure a bunch of stuff to justify moving it now into the place that we're developing. We'd love to hear, you know, people who are playing the game tell us what other stuff they'd like us to do.
There's a Facebook page too.
Facebook has a Takamel group that I'm not sure exactly who are the moderators, but a lot of Takamel-related discussion happens there. So we've chosen not to start a Baythorn group because it would just compete with that, and why do it, right? We're making a big effort. Like, the map of the Empire in Baythorn is just a new rendition of the exact same map that you saw in the original Empire of the Petal Throne, the exact same hex numbering system and scale and everything, because we want people to be able to pick up source material, and if it says hex 247 has this temple in it, we want that to be immediately usable to players of Baythorn, right? So we're not competing with other games that have come out for the setting. The company, though, Unigames, has a Facebook page. So we do that. And also there's a page for our system, the Pocket Universe system, which is what we use in Baythorn. So if you want to talk about rules questions, you can go there and not bother the people who might be playing original Empire of the Petal Throne that are hanging out in the Takamel group. And there's a website. Baythorn.com is the official website for Baythorn. And we have forums there as well. What else? Okay. I'm going to end it then. How far did I get?
Thank you so much.
I didn't even use 1 hour.
Thank you.
You're
very
welcome.
Much.
Thanks, everyone.